57 minutes, so
we got to jump on it. Okay, well, let's pray real quick. Lord, we thank you for this time together. We ask you to use it for your glory and your honor. In Jesus' name, amen. And with that, we'll jump in. I think. Yeah, there we go. Or a little loud. Let's wait till we start talking. We want to hear distinct words. Oh, yes. Sorry.
Says that he made the stars also. The Creator God made the stars. But what else do we really know about them? Jeffrey Burbidge is an eminent astrophysicist, well known in both the United States and Europe. And this is what he had to say. This quote really summarizes what I'm going to talk to you about today. Underlying all of the topics in the extragalactic universe and the physics of active galaxies are two basic beliefs, note, underlying beliefs, which are widely held. Number one, the cosmological evidence strongly suggests that the hot Big Bang model is generally correct. That's point one. And point two, which is much more relevant to my talk today, that redshifts of all objects outside of our galaxy, apart from some small velocity shifts, are due to local motions, are cosmological in origin. In other words, all the extragalactic redshifts are due to the expansion of the universe. He says, in my view, the general acceptance of these ideas and the subsequent edifices of the models that have been erected around these ideas is a fundamental mistake. The direction that research will take in the 21st century, however, may well lead to a compounding of that mistake, and I predict no immediate return to reality. And this guy is an expert in this field, and this is his opinion. So I want to show you a little bit more about this issue of redshifts. Everyone may recognize this. It's the Hubble Space Telescope. It is in orbit above the Earth, outside the atmosphere, where it has a very clear view of the sky, of the stars, and the cosmos. It has a much better view of the galaxies than any of the large Earth-based telescopes, like the big 8-meter ones in Hawaii. And this telescope has revolutionized what we know about the universe. It has taken many, many very surprising pictures that have changed the way astronomers think. Also, in recent years, there have been many new types of telescopes put into orbit, some that can see in X-rays, some in gamma rays, some that see in infrared light, and some that see in ultraviolet light, which we can't normally see with our eyes. This is a picture also that's been very popular, made very popular over the years. It's called the Hubble Deep Field, and it's a photograph taken with the Hubble Space Telescope over a period of about 10 days, 153-hour exposure, of a piece of the sky, for all purposes, looked black. There were very few stars in that area. It's the area is the size of what the moon looks like to us from Earth. So it's quite a large piece of the sky. Now, in amongst this picture, you'll see many galaxies, and more than 50% of those galaxies look just like the galaxies that we see around our galaxy, in our galactic neighborhood, if you like. And the rest of them are peculiar. but we'll talk a bit more about that later. In order to get an idea about the universe, the first thing I need to explain and you need to get an idea of is the distances in the universe, the size of the universe. So let's have a look at a few distance scales. The first one, the distance to our sun, from Earth to the sun, is 150 million kilometers, approximately. To get an idea of that, if you were driving your car there at 100 kilometers an hour or 60 miles an hour, it would take you 170 years to get to the sun if you took no toilet or bathroom stops, didn't have to repair the car or anything like that. It's quite a distance. Who knows what a light year is? Put your hand up if you think it's time, a measure of time. Put your hand up if you think it's a measure of distance. Well, put your hand up if you don't know. Oh, good, there's a few honest people here. But definitely, you're an educated lot. Yes, it's distance, a measure of distance. The speed of light is about 300,000 kilometers per second, and it's the distance that a pulse of light will travel in 1 year, which is quite a long distance, about 10 million, million kilometers, or 6 million, million miles. It's around 63,000 times the distance to the sun. Besides our sun, the closest star, Alpha Centauri, is four of those light years away, approximately. Now I want you to imagine, out to the distance of Alpha Centauri, place a sphere centered on the sun, and the edge of the sphere is out at that distance. It's like an empty ball, if you like. And then imagine that you take all the stars in the universe and you pack them into that ball. Well, you'd be very surprised to know that 100 billion galaxies of 100 billion stars, which is that number there, 10 to the 22, or 1 with 22 zeros after it, all those stars will fit into that ball without touching. This gives you some feeling of how large the universe is. And that's only out to our nearest neighbor star. It's very empty. When we look up into the night sky, away from Sydney, of course, and provided there's no moon, you'll have an opportunity to see something like this. And we're looking through our galaxy. We're looking towards the central galactic bulge, which is where most of the stars are concentrated, and we see a lot of gas and dust in that direction. If you look up, like directly above that, at 90 degrees, you see very few stars. Of course, this is called our Milky Way galaxy. To get some idea of the size of our galaxy, I hope you can see this. If you were in a spaceship and you flew up out of the galaxy, above the plane of the galaxy, and looked down, you would see it like that top picture, a large spiral structure with many arms. The size of that structure is around 100,000 light years across. If you then flew your spacecraft the other direction, out on the edge, you would see it looking like this. Now the next big galaxy, next to ours, is often called Andromeda, or M31 for the astronomers. It's approximately 2.5 million light years away. That's around 25 times the diameter of our galaxy. And it's roughly the same size as our galaxy. Now, what do astronomers really measure? Astronomers are scientists who work with light. They measure light. They have telescopes. The light can take many forms, though. It can be in, as I mentioned before, X-rays, gamma rays, infrared, a whole range. But they measure basically two things. And one is the brightness of stars or galaxies. We call it magnitude. From this magnitude, they determine distance. And the second thing they measure is redshift. So really they only measure two things, distance and redshift. Now I've explained a little bit about distance, so now I'll explain to you what redshift is. When you see a prism like this, it splits light, like a rainbow, scatters light into different colours or different frequencies. Now astronomers use this type of device to split light from stars and galaxies. The the gases on in stars, or the elements that are in the gases, will cause the light to scatter into this spectrum of various colours, but it will contain many lines. These lines here, red lines, blue lines, right through the spectrum. This one here is typical of nitrogen gas. And there are many, many different elements in stars, in their atmospheres, and from this type of analysis, we can determine what those elements are. Now, if an astronomer sees a spectrum like this, and the lines compared to a laboratory sample are all shifted towards the blue end of the spectrum, then they would call that blue shift. If the lines are all shifted towards the red end of the spectrum, they would call that red shift. So astronomers are not measuring anything but lines on a photographic plate or lines on a digital image taken from their, you know, modern digital CCD cameras. But what is the cause of redshift? I'd like to investigate this, and I'm going to illustrate it with a little picture here. This one is for the Doppler effect. Everyone is familiar with the effect of a train rushing by, and if it's coming towards you, you hear the sound, the pitch of the sound shifted up to a higher frequency. And if the train is moving away from you, the pitch of the sound is reduced to a lower frequency. This is for sound, but the Doppler effect occurs exactly the same with light. If the object is coming toward us, it would be a blue shift, and if the object is moving away from us, it would give us a red shift. So if an astronomer sees a red shift in starlight in a galaxy, he immediately thinks that the galaxy is moving away from the Earth. Would you trust this guy? Really, all you need to know about relativity is that speed and gravity affect time and lengths. And the most significant aspect of that in this discussion is time. My work involves very precise clocks. I work at a research lab in the University of Western Australia, and it involves clocks similar to this one. This is an atomic fountain clock. It's the latest generation of atomic clocks. And it cools a bunch of cold cesium atoms here and sends them up. It's called a fountain clock because it's like a fountain and comes down and they interrogate the atoms here. But in order for this clock to work at an optimal performance, at what they call a quantum limited performance, it needs one of the clocks that I build. And my type of clock is a classical clock. And it's made with a single crystal of pure man-made sapphire. That's about 5 centimeters in diameter. And it's placed in a cryostat and cooled to around about 6 Kelvin, which is roughly 270 degrees below zero in centigrade scale. And we build an oscillator based on this crystal, which has a quality that will allow us to build very, very precise clock. It's something like the arms of a grandfather clock that are maybe miles long. Our clock actually would gain or lose a second in around about 100 million years. So it's probably a lot more precise than anything you have on your hand, on your arm. Now, our clock is used as a flywheel to drive this atomic clock, something like the flywheel in a car, because the car only fires its piston every now and again. A flywheel keeps the timing. So ours is essentially the same. Ours has interrogates atoms 10 billion times a second, whereas the atomic clock only does it once per second. The atomic clock with ours will achieve the best accuracy of any timepiece in the universe. It is accurate to 100 trillionths of a second. So you can do a lot of very interesting measurements with that. You can measure the differential flow of time. If you place one of these clocks on the top of a mountain and one down in the valley, on the side of the mountain, you can measure the flow of time in these two locations and compare the two, and believe it or not, time flows more quickly on top of the mountain than it does in the valley. When I told my wife about this, she says, "Oh, does that mean the gravity bends the arms of the clock?" Well, in this case, there are no arms. It's the fact that gravity affects time. The stronger the gravity, the slower time passes. And this effect can be interpreted as a redshift effect, and that's why I'm telling you about it. GPS satellites are very common today. Anyone here have a GPS receiver? With this, you can tell where you are on the surface of the Earth. GPS is a collection, or 25, they call it a constellation. It's a man-made constellation of 25 low Earth orbit satellites, about 200 kilometers up, and your GPS receiver will determine its position on Earth by doing some sort of triangulation with the signals from those GPS satellites. And they all carry atomic clocks. However, what's interesting is the atomic clock on the satellite beats or ticks a fraction faster than the atomic clock on the ground. And so when the signal is received on the Earth, corrections have to be made. And it arrives roughly 42 picoseconds too soon, because the clock on the satellite is ticking a little bit faster than the clock on Earth. The exactly same type of clock, I mean. Picosecond, by the way, is a trillionth of a second. It's not very much, but if you add it up over a year, it adds up to a few microseconds. So it has to be corrected for. This atomic clock they use is an earlier version of a cesium beam clock. If they used our new super-duper clock, you would be able to improve your accuracy. I think currently you have a precision of about 100 meters, something like that. If you used our clock, you could know your position on the surface of the Earth to 1 centimeter. And you could even build bridges and buildings using GPS with such a system. This effect, and this gravitational effect, causes redshifting of the light from our sun. The mass of our sun is pretty massive, 10 to the 30 kilograms, that's 1 with 30 zeros in kilograms, and it's quite large, around 1,400,000 kilometers in diameter. From this we can calculate the redshift. It's pretty small, 0.00004. That's pretty small redshift. It's a little bit too small to measure. But redshift for other stars is routinely measured. So that's two forms of redshift, Doppler and gravitational. And the other form is called cosmological, or due to the expansion of space. So we call it a space expansion or cosmological redshift. And the way this works is, if you can imagine this nebula here, started out with blue light, and the light left the nebula and travels on through the universe towards the Earth. And when the light is received at the Earth, the wavelengths are stretched out and it appears reddened. And the reason is, between the time the beam of light left the nebula and the time it arrived on Earth, the universe expanded, and this causes a stretching of the wavelengths. This effect causes a redshift that's indistinguishable, in fact, from the Doppler effect. You know, this is the one due to the velocity. In fact, astronomers always refer to redshift as velocity, because they can't distinguish between the two effects. In 1920, there was a guy called Vesta Slipher, and he noticed that the light from galaxies was redshifted. He looked in their spectra and he see the lines were shifted towards the red. And later Edwin Hubble, who actually for many decades catalogued and measured the redshift of galaxies. And he noticed an interesting effect. And I've tried to illustrate it by these red lines here in the image here, in the slide, that the greater the distance the galaxy was, the greater the redshift, which to an astronomer means something like it's moving away much faster. But more importantly, this effect was seen right across the sky in all directions. And this effect has become known as the Hubble law, which says the greater the distance to the galaxy, the greater the redshift. The constant of proportionality has become called the Hubble constant, or the Hubble parameter, which I'm sure many of you here have heard of. This is really what Hubble saw. He was sitting on Earth and he saw the galaxies all moving away from the Earth. He came to realize from this that he was located at the center of the universe, because in every direction he looked, this law applied: the greater the distance, the greater the redshift. And he realized he must be at the center of the universe. But the Big Bang people would have us believe that we are located on a galaxy, or in a galaxy, on a planet, of no special importance, of no significance in the universe. And Hubble was obviously very tormented by this idea, and he wrote in his 1937 book, "Such a condition would imply we occupy a unique position in the universe." But he says it's intolerable. So his bias, his preconceived notions, forced him to conclude that there must be another solution, that the obvious could not be true. And he says it represents a discrepancy with the theory, because the theory postulates homogeneity, which means that the universe is the same everywhere. And so his bias overrides even what his observations were telling him. So astronomers and cosmologists have tried to reconcile this, and I'll explain that in a minute. But just to, so you get a bit of a better understanding of what Hubble was really looking at, it's illustrated by this slide. Really, galaxies move in clusters, and within a cluster, they have local motions, but moving in different directions. Occasionally, you'll find a galaxy that's actually moving toward us. And those few galaxies have blue shifts. So nearly all clusters of galaxies, and nearly all galaxies, in fact, have red shifts. But a few have blue shifts. And one of them is Andromeda, the M31, moving about 100 kilometers per second toward us. But don't worry, it's a long way away. So astronomers interpret that as expansion of the galaxies into the universe, where the cosmologists interpret it as the expansion of the universe. Now, I have to explain a little bit about Big Bang, which you've seen this quote before. The universe burst into something from absolutely nothing, zero, nada, and as it got bigger, it became filled with even more stuff that came from absolutely nowhere. This is from Alan Guth, who is the author of the inflation model, the Hot Big Bang inflation model. And he said, just after the Big Bang, in fact, 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, million times in only 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, So just reviewing here, what cosmologists really believe is that the galaxies are fixed in the space and the space itself expands, something like this. That they propose this model because they have to get around this issue of us being at the center of the universe. So instead they suppose that the universe can have a center anywhere or everywhere. There are two types of Big Bang models. There are many models, but there's two types of classes of models. And one type, both types have no edge, unbounded, no edge, but one type is like something like the space we think we live in now. It's flat space, not curved, and it goes on forever and ever and ever and ever. It's infinite in expanse. And in such a universe, you could move anywhere and you would see approximately the same picture, like the center is everywhere. The second type of model that has been very popular over the years is where the universe is finite in size, unbounded, but finite. So if you were in a spaceship and you could live long enough, you could fly off in one direction, and eventually, because the space is curved like a ball, you would come back to the same place. And in that model also, you could move to any galaxy in that model and look out at the stars, and it would appear like you're at the center of the universe. So this is the the Big Bang cosmologists' solution to this problem that Hubble had. And it goes something like this. If you imagine this girl blowing this balloon up, and instead of those little galaxies drawn on the balloon, a more correct representation would be to imagine them as like buttons glued on. So when she blows up the balloon, the buttons don't get any bigger. They just expand with the expansion. It's like a two-dimensional representation. It's not an explosion of matter into space, as we would understand it. It's an expansion of the space itself. And the surface of a balloon is something like our globe. It's two-dimensional. And what you have to then imagine, that you add an extra dimension, and it's curved into a fourth dimension. Now, it's pretty hard to imagine things in three dimensions, let alone in four. Humans just can't do that. In fact, they call that, I like this word, they call it a 5D brain world, five-dimensional brain world, B-R-A-N-E. One might think they need to get a brain sometimes. So let's review. What do we really know? One is astronomers measure distance and redshift. Two, for very distant galaxies, the Hubble War is used. So really they only measure redshift, and from the redshift they determine distance. So for most of the distant galaxies, in fact most of the real usable part of the universe for cosmology and Big Bang cosmology, is they need the very distant galaxies. And so really they're only measuring redshift, not distance. Astronomers call redshift a recession speed. And it's something like the Doppler effect. Cosmologists interpret it in terms of the galaxies being stationary in the space, and the space is expanding and getting larger, and therefore the galaxies appear to be rushing away from us, the observer. So there are three possible causes of redshift. Remember, they only measure redshift. After that, it's an interpretation on what that redshift really means. It could be due to velocity or Doppler, gravitational, or cosmological expansion, the expansion of space. Now, this is a very simplistic view of what the Big Bang model says about the formation of the universe and galaxies in particular. First, there was the Big Bang, and it exploded, and there was a lot of radiation, which was a hot ball, fireball, expanding out. And then there was a separation of matter into antimatter, and that's got a lot of problems, but we won't go into that here. And then from the matter, not the antimatter, but the matter, was the formation of galaxies and stars, which according to Stephen Hawking's latest book, he still doesn't know how they were formed. Mind you, if you take all the stars and galaxies out of the universe, you don't really have much left to work with. And from the formation of galaxies, they were split into two main types of galaxies. One is elliptical type galaxies, which are like these balls of fuzz. They have no spiral structure to them. They're not really rotating. And the other type are spiral type galaxies, which have these beautiful spiral structured arms, like the galaxy that we live in. Initially, galaxies tend to start out as being very active, disturbed, emitting a lot of gamma rays, X-rays, very violent type of places. And after billions of years, they're supposed to settle down into being quiet, docile, inactive galaxies like the one we live in. But is this really the case? The picture here is of the astronomer Alton Arp. For 29 years, he worked as an astronomer at Palomar and Wilson observatories, and he's taken many pictures of very strange and peculiar galaxies. Alton Arp is not a crackpot. He's an eminent scientist, and he realized that picture I just described to you before is not correct. That there are many, many, many galaxies that don't fit the picture. And because of his rather controversial work, He was banned from any more telescope time in the large American telescopes, and he was more or less banished to Germany. Now he works at the Max Planck Institute. But he has come up with many very interesting observations that I want to explain to you now. Here is a galaxy, and it has a companion galaxy next to it. This galaxy here, the large central one, has a redshift of around 8,700 kilometers per second. Remember I told you astronomers always write redshift down as a velocity, so don't be concerned about that. This one here, which is next to it, has a redshift of 17,000 kilometers per second. According to the Hubble law, which says the greater the distance, the greater the redshift, it would mean that this galaxy would be close and this galaxy should be very, very far in the background. And this is what the Big Bang community would say, that it's an accidental coincidence that this galaxy just lies so close to the other one in the line of sight. They are not actually physically close to each other. Okay, that would be fair enough, but there's a problem. Ultanarp is found, and it's hard to see here, but there are bridges of material that actually physically connect the two galaxies. They are physically connected to each other with gases that emit X-rays and other material, stars and dust and so on. So this brings into doubt the whole Hubble law regime upon which Big Bang cosmology hangs. This is a picture of Markian 205, that's the one up in the top right-hand corner. It's a quasar-like object, and I'm going to explain to you in a minute what quasars are. And this one here is a galaxy which is a disrupted spiral, very active, meaning it's emitting a lot of high-energy radiation like X-rays and gamma rays. This one here, the quasar-like object, has a redshift of 0.46 and one of 0.6, which is nearly half the speed of light. When I write it like this, it means it's a fraction of the speed of light. So it's moving away, according to Hubble law, very quickly. And this one has a very small redshift, which is only 7% the speed of light. So according to Hubble law again, this one should be very close, and this one should be right out on the edge of the visible universe, and should have no connection between these two objects. Several years ago, Art published a paper showing that there was a bridge connecting these two objects, a bridge of gas and dust, X-ray emitting material. So the Hubble telescope was placed only a year or two back. They looked at this object and they published these images to disprove Art's paper, that there was no connection. Now, I hope you can see this, but I've reversed the image and changed the contrast. The image itself actually shows a physical connection between the two objects. And this is the image that the Big Bang community used to disprove Zarp's hypothesis that they were physically connected. Yet they've actually even proved it further. This image here is taken in X-rays. So instead of using light to form the photograph, they've used X-rays. The colours are false, just so that you can see it. They're false colour image. And this object is Markian 205, which was that very small object in the top right-hand corner of the previous slide. It actually has three quasars in it. And there's one that's 1.26, which is very, very close to the speed of light, if you believe the Doppler interpretation of redshift. We only measure the redshift of the lines. We don't actually measure velocities, and we're not really measuring distance. So what ARP has shown, that these objects are all physically connected to each other. You can see that X-ray emitting material, these red lines, envelop these other objects. It's all one connected object, and these are disturbed X-ray emitting galaxies of some kind. So if ARP is correct, he indicates, at least for a class of objects like these very active objects called quasars, that the Hubble law doesn't work. And this is completely a complete radical view in terms of the standard Big Bang model. So what is a quasar? Does anyone know? Can anyone tell me what a quasar is? No. Well, I'll tell you something. No one else knows either. There's no astronomer that knows what a quasar is. Yet there's hundreds of thousands, maybe millions and millions of them in our visible universe. Just to describe a little about what they are, they're often called QSOs or quasi-stellar object. The word quasar comes from quasi-stellar radio source. Originally they were first seen only in radio waves with the first radio telescopes. They are very star-like. If you look at them, they don't look like a galaxy. They look like a star. Very bright and very compact, like a pinpoint of light. And they have a spectrum that's quite different from a star. Now, I don't know if you know this, but our sun emits radiation mostly in infrared and visible light. There's a very strong peak in the spectrum in that range, and that's so life on Earth can exist. The infrared is for heating, for warmth, and the visible light is so we can see, photosynthesis and so on. However, a quasar emits radiation right across the frequency band. Gamma rays, X-rays, radio waves, optical light, visible light, infrared, ultraviolet, everything. And it's flat. It's the same amount of radiation across all the different regions of the spectrum. They have very bright emission lines, like I showed you those lines in the nitrogen gas, and they all have very large redshifts. The secular astronomer, cosmologist, believes that they are supermassive black holes with maybe like a million or 100 million times the mass of our sun, all packed into a black hole with a very large accretion disk, a disk of matter circling around it that causes it to radiate a lot of light and is very bright. This is an artist's picture of a black hole with a star nearby getting sucked into that black hole. So this is only a black hole with a mass of like our sun. So they're imagining that the quasars have millions of times the size of our sun, the mass the size of our sun. And the idea is they have accretion disk around the black hole, and it radiates a lot of material, like this here, and also a lot of light. This is an object in the galaxy NGC 4438 that astronomers suspect is a real black hole. This is a picture taken with the Hubble Space Telescope, and it seems to have a disk around it, and it seems to be radiating matter out of its central spin axis. However, this object is around 10 million times too dim to be a quasar. It's much, much, much too dim. So even the few suspected black holes don't appear to look like quasars. This is one of the first quasars ever observed. It looks like a star, very, very bright. And notice there's some material being ejected out of it. That's just there. So it's interesting that if these quasars are out on the edge of the universe, you shouldn't be able to see any stars around them. And this photograph here is the same quasar where a disk was placed with the telescope. They placed a disk over the bright central image, and they could see fuzz around the quasar. It appears that you can see the stars that are in some sort of a galaxy around this quasar image. That also is a problem for Big Bang cosmology, because if it's out on the edge of the universe, you shouldn't be able to see anything. But according to Arp's interpretation, he suggests that quasars are a lot closer. They're not so distant, and that their redshift is not due to the Hubble law, not due to the expansion of the universe. This is a picture taken in X-rays and in light, visible light. The colour part of the picture is a galaxy taken with the visible light, and the lines are X-ray images. So it shows the intensity of the objects. And there's a quasar here and a quasar here. These are X-ray quasars because they're very strongly emitting X-rays. In optical, if you look in visible light, you'll see them as a blue stellar object. That's why it's called a BSO. This type of galaxy is a very active galaxy. They're known as Cepheid galaxies. And they they are very disturbed and radiate enormous amounts of very deadly gamma and X-rays. What's interesting though is ARP has found there are many examples where you find two quasars or more paired across a galaxy. That's across what we call the minor axis. This is the spin axis, and that one there is the major axis. That's like the flat plane of the galaxy. Here's another example. This in the center is a Cepheid galaxy with a very low redshift, and there are two quasar-like objects with large redshifts, and they seem to be aligned across the minor axis of the galaxy. There are many, many examples of this, and ARP has published many on his webpage. In this one here, this is called ultra-luminous infrared galaxy, or galaxies. This one is called ARP-220, and there's a number of galaxies here. There's a collection here. This galaxy here has a very low redshift, and these ones here also very low redshift, compared to these two X-ray quasars, which have very, very large redshift. So if you believe the Hubble law and the Big Bang interpretation, these quasars should be billions of light years away from these galaxies here. But they seem to be connected by all this hydrogen gas, which is emitting X-rays. And it also appears like this one was ejected, this object was ejected from this galaxy or group of galaxies, and possibly even this one ejected this way from this galaxy. So this is now a schematic, it's a summary of ARP's work over many, many years, and there are many, many examples of this. He has found that if you look at a galaxy edge on, that within about 20 degrees of this minor axis, he finds pairs of quasars or quasi-stellar objects. In fact, in many cases, there's multiple numbers of them. So he is suggesting that the quasars are physically associated with those galaxies, and in fact, that they have been ejected from the galactic cores, which is a very different creation scenario from what the Big Bang people believe, because they believe all galaxies in the universe were created about only a billion years after the Big Bang. So what's the big deal? Why are Big Bang cosmologists so adamant about the distance to quasars? If redshifts for quasars are not due to expansion of the cosmos, then they must have a different cause, right? Maybe it's something intrinsic, but it's not due to the expansion of the universe. So that would change our view of the universe as to where these objects, these quasars, where they are located. So that means the assumed distances to the vast majority of galaxies, active galaxies and quasars in the universe is wrong. This means the Big Bang model comes crashing down. The reason it discredits the Big Bang is summarized in these two points. The key assumptions of the Big Bang are, one, that the origin of all matter was in the hot Big Bang. All matter and therefore all galaxies. And two, that many distances that are determined from quasar redshifts, particularly all the very distant objects. The main thrust of ARP's observations are, if quasar redshifts are not related to the Hubble law, not related to distance, and therefore the Hubble law, then the Hubble law doesn't work for quasars anyway. And two, that matter is created from the center of active galaxies, which are also quasars. In fact, ARP's view is that there's a whole range of types of active galaxies, from Cepheid galaxies all the way through to very active quasars. If this view was not of importance, then Joseph Silk wouldn't have written this in his book entitled Big Bang. And he says, in regard to ARP's interpretation, that this ejection of matter from the cores or the centers of galaxies, he says, only by disputing the interpretation of quasar redshifts as a cosmological distance indicator can this conclusion be avoided. He knows it's so important that they cannot allow this interpretation that ARP is promoting, because otherwise the whole of the Big Bang cosmology will collapse like a house of cards. This is a schematic of what ARP suggests is actually happening. You have a parent galaxy, and from either side of a parent galaxy you have ejection of a quasar pair. After time, the quasar is moving away from the parent galaxy, and its redshift, we call Z here, the redshift, drops down, seems to drop down, and slowly the object changes into various type of active galaxies or blue stellar objects, or there's another kind called a BLAC object, and eventually becomes a normal galaxy. And the other way I've tried to illustrate other aspects of this, where it may become a very active X-ray quasi-stellar object or this BLAC object, and sometimes they split up into multiple galaxy clusters. So this is the interpretation, and this is one of the beautiful galaxy clusters called Abel 2218 that ARP suggests originated from this ejection of matter process, taken by the Hubble Space Telescope, of course. So my view is this, that we're looking at a creation process, something like a fireworks display, where you see the little embers explode, and from the centers of burning embers you find more material coming out, and then they explode, and so on, in some sort of grand hierarchy. Do you get it? So what I'm telling you is, I suggest that ARP is correct. But for a creationist, what is actually happening is we are seeing the creation of galaxies at the very creation itself on day four. Because we can look out into the cosmos, we are essentially looking back in time a little bit. And we are seeing the creative process of God, who created the universe through a grand hierarchy, where he created galaxy from galaxy, all on day four of creation week. So we are seeing God's creative process right now, not after the fact, but actually as it's happening. It happened 6,000 years ago on Earth clocks, not millions and billions of years ago. If we look in the northern sky around the Fornax galaxy, and we take ARP's interpretation of distances, we see it forms a giant S shape. Not only did God create his universe with galaxies with spiral structure, he formed the structure, he formed the galaxies into a supermassive spiral structure, a supercluster of clusters, all in a giant spiral structure. And that's in the northern hemisphere around the Fornax cluster, Fornax galaxy. In the southern hemisphere, there is another one around the Virgo cluster. This is what the Big Bang universe would look like, with the Big Bang assumptions and interpretations. The yellow are quasars and the green are galaxies. Now let's look at what the universe would look like with the ARP model applied. However, the size there should be contracted down by about 100 times. I've allowed it to be large so you can see the difference. So the universe looks a lot emptier. It's just that we can't see beyond there. There are very few galaxies we can see beyond our local superclusters, the Virgo and Fornax superclusters. To top it off, the redshifts of these quasars ejected from these galaxies seems to fall into certain special numbers. When they've looked at collections of quasar redshifts, like 7,000 of them, they found they all fell very close to these special redshift numbers. Nobody has been able to explain that as yet. I have a view as to what quasars are. I believe that they may be white holes. Everyone's heard of a black hole. Well, a white hole is a black hole running backwards in time, time reversed. Matter is pouring out of the white hole, and it's very bright. In fact, observations indicate that matter is only seen to be leaving. It is never seen to be falling in. If it was a black hole, we would see matter falling in. The cause of the redshift, my guess, is its gravitational redshift. And these are supermassive white holes that have very, very high gravitational redshift. The effect of the redshift dropping down to different amounts is like peeling an onion. You take a layer of matter off, and the redshift drops down. Take another one, and drops down even further. So my conclusion is, God made the stars, and we're seeing them, and the Big Bang cannot explain it.
Learn anything?
Yes.
Good.
Ken Ham is from Australia.
Yeah.
Yes. You recall where Barry Satterfield's from?
I'll show you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Does this mean we can't watch a TV show, Big Bang? New series?
Go ahead. Okay. Let's see. We have. I've cheated you guys. I didn't realize we're supposed to have a break at the hour. We've got about 4 minutes till break time. any thoughts? Any discussion?
Concerning that past video?
Yeah. It's interesting. Creationists at this point don't really have a good creation model. The whole idea of modeling things in science is that you try to use known physics to explain things that you see. Well, I don't know we'll ever have a really good model. Good creation model, because creation wasn't done naturally. It was created supernaturally. But God is the author of physics. He's the author of the laws of physics. And to what extent he implemented those laws and used them at the point of creation, you know, we don't know. But there are some interesting things to think about. And he didn't get into some of the other problems with Big Bang theory, but there are a number of them that are very serious problems. And there are quite a lot of people now in the scientific community that recognize that Big Bang really doesn't work. It's got great press because, you know, the gatekeepers, the people with the microphones keep telling us, oh, we know this is true, this is true. Yeah, it's a lot of hogwash. But there are a lot of interesting things to think about.
One thing that really caught my attention was how he was talking about the evidence from ARP, and his conclusion that we're seeing in the stars creation going on.
Yeah.
And like when you brought the Einstein's theory of relativity into the equation, and he's talking about the clocks that he works with, mm-hmm. and how you have different times depending on the gravitational pull, I was like, man, that's crazy. Like when you think about the bend in time because of gravity, that could be looking into the past.
Yeah.
And I found that very intriguing. That was cool.
It is. Yeah?
At CBMC, Christian Businessmen's Committee, mm-hmm. we had Hugh Ross speak at lunch.
Why?
And of course, he is a long earther.
Yeah.
Which is different than this guy, a young earther.
Yeah.
And Hugh Ross, we know, is very, very intelligent. How do you explain the difference in their viewpoints?
I don't. We had a class in this room in May on the age of the earth. And the first part was presented by old earthers, and then the second part was presented by young earthers. And that's our break. We have 10 minutes. Your break is officially started. Please be back in 10 minutes. If you want to stay and talk, that's all right too, but you've got a break.
Okay. I want to get a sense of what I need to hear.
I asked Hugh Ross how he reacted to Barry Sudderfield's theories. He said Barry's calculations were out of the margin of error. That makes sense?
Did you go to school and with a scientific background, or you were just intrigued and studied?
Well,
how did you come about doing these
types of things? I got a degree in biology. And then my wife and I got married before I was out my senior year. I actually had some classes to finish up in the summer. Mm-hmm. So we got married that summer, and then we lived on campus at Azusa Pacific while she finished it. Mm-hmm. And I got a job working for the Moody Institute of Science. For a couple of years, and then I fell back on my background in drafting primarily. Mm-hmm. And I just did a lot of crazy things. At one point I was a tool design engineer for the B-2 bomber.
Wow.
And you see, the thing is, my dad was a prolific inventor, and you know, had a little shop in the garage, and so I was kind of his sounding board. So all of his inventions, you know, he'd tell me about them. And,
oh, that's good.
And so
sounds like my own life.
Sorry about that.
In public schools, we could use a lot of Moody films, 50 movies. Creation science, pointing to God, is wonderful. Now the public schools are anti-Christ for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's take a look at the questions. Well, yeah, we'll discuss them.
Remember, Jim, that guy in class, the one you did the stop action development?
Yeah.
Speak to that just for fun, because I thought those were marvelous films.
Okay, well, I took Don's class when he taught creation science class for the Bible school here. And I don't even know how it came up now, but at one point I told about a project that I had worked on when I was at the Moody Institute of Science. And that project, my assignment was to collect monarch butterfly larvae and raise them, keep them in the lab, you know, feeding on milkweed. And then when they formed the chrysalis, I would run and get the guy that was in charge of time-lapse photography, Charlie Gratz, and he would, you know, we'd film the actual process of shaking off the skin and all that stuff. But then, when it formed the chrysalis, I would use an X-Acto knife and cut a little window in the chrysalis and use wax to seal onto that a little cover slip, you know, for a microscope. So it's a little glass window. So I have a glass window right into the chrysalis. And then you'd set up in front of a time-lapse camera. And so once every 10 minutes, lights would come on. It would click two frames. Lights would go out. And then wait for 10 minutes and do it again. And so the idea was to be able to watch the whole development. Well, we never got that far. Because one of the things they did there was on the weekends they'd turn off the air conditioning. And so you get rather warm. And with temperature changes and so forth, the wax would crack. And so we'd get the rushes back and take the film into Hollywood and get it developed and bring it back. And we'd have a work print on the original and so forth. And so we'd bring it back and show it on the screen. And you'd see this absolutely fantastic thing going on. You're looking into this world of emerald green, and it's throbbing. I mean, it's just throbbing with life, because this little thing, the whole time it goes through the metamorphosis, still has a heartbeat. There's still a pulse. Even though the whole body is broken down into its juices, and, you know, you have it's like stem cells are reprogrammed. So at one time, they directed the development of all the differentiation, the different types of cells and where they went and all that to form the larva. Mm-hmm. And now everything's reprogrammed so they create a whole new creature, the butterfly. And so as you're watching this thing on the screen, you can see antennae that are curled up and legs, you know, these spindly legs just coalescing out of this green jelly. And the whole thing is throbbing with life, you know. It's just absolutely beautiful. You can see the networks of veins and the wings, and they're all folded up. The whole thing's prepackaged, you know. And just absolutely fascinating to watch. And then all at once, it would look like somebody puked into the thing, where the bacteria would get in, and they'd just proliferate and grow, and the thing would die and shrink up like a black mummy, you know. Just, oh, it's horrifying to watch, you know. And so we did it several times, and that was the end result each time, was it would dry up and die, or die and then dry up. So anyway, I told this to the class, and there was some drunk that had wandered into the class, and he sat there in the room, and Don let him, you know, he didn't disturb anybody. But when I told that, he got all upset about how cruel I was to cut windows in the butterfly chrysalis, and got up and stomped out, and I don't guess we ever saw him again, did we? Anyway, that was the story. Okay, chapter 2. Let's just take a look at the questions. First question I put, these are all true and false. Mutations are typographical errors in the Book of the Dead. True or false? Now, I'm not going to tell you the answer. I want to hear you talk about it. We've got some guesses here. True or false?
Typographical meaning that it's just like an error within the gene?
Yeah. Like, because, you know, we saw this this parallel before in the first chapter. Yeah. Let's see if we can find that, how it actually says it.
And the referral to the Book of the Dead, is that
Isn't there an Egyptian book called the Book of the Dead?
Yes, there is.
And is that the one it's referring to? Or no?
Well, the answer should be in the book.
If it is, I'd say no.
Okay. There's a place here in chapter 1 where he talked about the parallels, that the nucleotides are letters, and I forget what he said. Chromosomes are like chapters, but it's very much like a book. And the base pairs, they call nucleotides, are really letters. You know, they're little elements of code that describe the structure of a life form. What is that? Anybody find it? Take a look through chapter 1 real quick and see if you find the comparison. Where he talks about the letters and the chapters in the book.
Page 2, talking about these molecules are the letters of genetic code and are shown symbolically as A, T, C, and D.
Yes.
That's on page 2, middle paragraph.
Good. These letters are strung together like a linear text. They are not just symbolically shown as letters, they are very literally the letters of our instruction manual. Mm-hmm. Small clusters or motifs of these four molecular letters make up the words of our manual, which combine to form genes, the chapters of our manual, which combine to form chromosomes, the volumes of our manual, which combine to form the whole genome, the entire library.
Mm. So these letters, though, do they represent amino acids, or what do they represent?
Well, they're code, and they're in they're clusters of them, so that you have like a run of three form a codon, which specify an amino acid.
Okay, so the combination of them would create or specify?
It specifies to a cellular machine in a cell how to build one chromosome, how to specify one amino acid.
Oh, okay.
Okay? And so you can find charts, he doesn't include it in the book, but you can find charts that show for most life forms what that code is, you know, what this codon, this group of nucleotides, specifies this amino acid, and so forth. Okay. You look at the combinations. And it turns out that some of them can specify more than one amino acid, or rather the other way around. Some amino acids can be specified more than one way, two or even three ways.
Okay.
Now, the interesting thing that I didn't know for a long, long time is that's called the genetic code, as if there's only one. Guess what? Turns out there's something like 17 different genetic codes for different life forms.
Wow.
So that assignment of amino acid being designated by a particular set of codons, a codon, differs in some different life forms. So, and they're arbitrary. There's nothing mechanical, nothing physical that requires a particular codon to specify, to cause to be created a particular amino acid. It's an arbitrary language that God built into the system. And when you see this, this is what you build. When you see this, this is what you build. And the fact that there are multiple kinds of these codes, like I say, 17, I believe it was the number, just shows you that it's not necessity that makes it happen. It's a language. Fascinating stuff.
So, within the different genetic codes that we see, are you saying that in the different genetic code, you could have a different structure of what nucleotides, that the term used for the letters.
Yeah.
To specify the same amino acid and build a different creature.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. And even in our code, some amino acids can be specified in multiple ways.
Mm.
And but even those different ways that you can specify an amino acid may still have some influence on the way the amino acids are strung together and folded. Because there are multiple things going on. You have, you know, the one thing is the linear code. You look at a strip of DNA and you say, okay, this nucleotide sequence of three, this codon specifies an amino acid, the next one another amino acid. So you string these amino acids together. And that's one layer of complexity, is just the linear sequence. But then, those things fold up. So these chains, these polypeptide chains, fold up into very specific shapes. And there are parts of them that have to be related, you know, geometrically, where they come in space to one another to do their job. And what happens when you cook things, you heat them up, is all that folding gets destroyed. It all comes apart, it gets all tangled up, and now they don't work anymore. So you denature the protein, now you can eat it and digest it. But and if there's any bacteria in it, small amounts of bacteria, when you cook it, you denature the bacterial DNA, and it's safe to eat. If you don't cook it, not so safe. Okay. Question two. According to the primary axiom, mutations are good.
Yes. They believe it's good. It allows for selection.
Yeah, the whole evolutionary thing, the whole, well, you know, they really, I might ought to backpedal just a little bit. Theistic evolutionists believe that God used evolution to create all of life. And there are different flavors of theistic evolutionists. Some theistic evolutionists believe that God used a purely natural system to create all of life. So he wasn't really involved. He just put this evolutionary mechanism in place and it created life. But another version of theistic evolution is that God's constantly tinkering with natural processes to create mutations and variation and so forth. So, but the basic concept of evolution is that God really has no part in it, and that it's all nature. So every aspect of your body, every aspect of your life, the software in your head, the software in your cells, all of it, physical and software, is just the result of mutations. So we're just walking bags of mutations. Yeah, all accidents. Filtered accidents. Natural selection is the filter. Okay. Question three. Part of the primary axiom is that all genetic variation must come from random mutations. And so, and there again, there's that little caveat for some theistic evolutionists will take out the random. They say, well, yeah, they're mutations, but maybe God directs some of them. Question four. The hairless Chihuahua dog is a good example of a beneficial mutation that adds new genetic information to the dog's genome. What do you think?
Read it again, Jim.
The hairless Chihuahua dog is a good example of a beneficial mutation that adds new genetic information to the dog's genome. You know, you have a little dog who lives down in really, really hot weather, and if it's got a lot of fur on it, you know, it's going to be hot, and it's going to have a hard time cooling off, And, you know, dogs don't have sweat glands. So how's this poor little dog going to survive? Well, he gets this mutation, and Terrell falls out. So he got a hairless chihuahua, and so it stays cooler, right? So that's beneficial, right? Beneficial mutation. That's new information, right?
Not degeneration.
So right. If the hair falls out, you reckon something's already there, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, question five. There are over 5 billion potential point mutation sites in the human genome. True or false? Okay, those of you who put false, why did you put false? You found the sentence in the book that the question came from? And what did the sentence in the book say?
Best source.
Pardon?
3 billion.
Yeah. So that's my attempt at being sneaky.
Okay,
question six. Kimura calls near neutral mutations effectively neutral, meaning that they are so subtle that they are not subject to selection. True or false? Everybody agree? Did you find the sentence that the question came from? Now I keep forgetting. You just got the book because I just gave it to you. So. Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to chapter 3. A recent finding, question 1, true or false? A recent finding is that the human mutation rate, just within our reproductive cells, is in the range of 75 to 175 nucleotide substitutions, misspellings, per person, per generation. True or false? Well, if you find the sentence the question came from, it should be an easy answer. But the real question is that really all? Are there really only 75 to 175 point mutations per person per generation? Or, yeah, well, okay. Well, that didn't say point mutations, but let me read the question again. A recent finding is that the human mutation rate just within our reproductive cells is in the range of 75 to 175 nucleotide substitutions, misspellings, per person, per generation. So that doesn't necessarily have to be point mutations. A point mutation is just a substitution of one nucleotide for another. So there are other ways that can happen. It might not just be a mistake at that point, a point mutation. And maybe there's a frame shift or something else so that you have substitutions but for more than just individual points. Kind of warm in here to you guys? Oh, I should have turned this projector off. That helps a little. Let me open the door. Next question, question two. What's that, Don?
We had an Orange County football coach's tribute in Orange. the football coach of Villa Park, head football coach of Dusan Ancic, he's one of my old students that beat us at CF semi. So the Tillers got big on old Tiller. Dusan Ancic at the meeting tribute said, "Mr. Richardson, remember when you showed that film of that singer that looked like you in class, Dusan Ancic?" I said, "Yes, I do." His name, the old singer, was Billy Joel. This is Joel here, of course.
I wonder how this connected.
And then I saw. So, I want to make one point, and that is that in the genetic code, God built in variety in the genetic code.
Yes, he did.
So that every particular animal species has the ability to adapt to the environment. Joel's ancestors got off the boat with Noah. We all did. They moved to areas where the sun was very, very bright. And the pigment in the skin is the same for everyone. And Joel's ancestors developed the pigment which protected them from the sun. My ancestors grew up in the North Pole. Very little sun comparison. And that same pigment, we developed very, very little. Then I moved down here to Southern California where we have a lot of sun. And my ancestors didn't have the benefit of that pigment. But now I have skin cancer.
That'll teach it. Quit growing up at the North Pole. You know, you're talking about some variation is built in and some, you know, comes by mutation, for sure. But it is assumed, like, not very many years ago, the guy who was behind the genome project, you know, to decipher the human genome.
Is that like
O2? Collins, I think. Anyway, he formed a group called BioLogos. And BioLogos, you know, their whole thing is theistic evolution. But then the natural theistic evolution, pretty much. And so they have written articles and published papers declaring that, you know, the Bible can't be true, that we can't... it isn't possible for all the variation in humankind to come from just two people, Adam and Eve. So the story of Adam and Eve has to be a myth. Well, they began with the assumption, a major assumption, that there was no heterozygosity in Adam and Eve.
There was no what, Jim?
Heterozygosity. That is... that, you know, we each have two chromosomes. You know, chromosomes come in pairs. And so what they were declaring to be fact was that the biblical Adam and Eve would have had to have had all the same genes on both sides. You know, for each pair of chromosomes, both chromosomes have exactly the same genes lined up side by side. Well, most likely, I mean, what you find among people is we'll have a gene on one chromosome and it's allele on another variation of that gene. And so like blue eyes and brown eyes and, you know, that kind of thing, you get these combinations that result in variation. And in the process of reproduction, you get crossover from one parent to the other so that a child's makeup will be, you know, segments of its chromosomes will be from the mother, segments of it, of the same chromosome, will be from the father. And so by this process of recombination, we get a lot of variation. Well, Adam and Eve, very likely God created them with total heterozygosity. So they had maximum amount of variation built into them so that their kids, when they're, you know, when they form by this recombination, by sexual reproduction, the assortment of these alleles was probably such that we could have had, you know, there may have been people like we'll never see again. I mean, we talk about colors. There may have been blue people and green people and, you know, pink people and, well, I'm pink anyway. anyway, all kinds of possibilities that as... Well, let's see if we can do this a little bit. I don't know. But as Adam and Eve's children paired up and moved away, then you would have some regions where they would have some alleles that they wouldn't have. It would just be, you know, that couple had this combination.
Isolated.
Yeah. So you have little parts of the genome, they get fractionated, and they become isolated. And so these over here, they can only produce offspring that have the genes that they had. They're still going to be recombined in all kinds of various ways, but they're not going to have some of the genes that Adam and Eve had. And the same for these over here, and these over here, and these over here. So you're going to have all kinds of little population centers that look different from one another. And so, you know, it's a very natural thing to expect. The whole thing about the variation of animals, you know, how many animals roam the ark kind of thing. And so people who want to criticize and scoff at the idea that there could be a boat big enough to carry all the different animals on the ark, what they don't realize is that God told Noah to bring pairs of each kind of animal.
And all the different...
Right.
Yeah.
And so the kind probably wasn't at the species level.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and species, the way we speak of species, a little bit arbitrary anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's supposed to be that a species is a group of animals that are capable of reproducing among themselves. And it turns out that lions and tigers can reproduce, and you know, all kinds of different things are able to reproduce because they're the same kind. They're not the same species, but the same kind. Well, if they're not the same species, how come they can reproduce? So the word species needs to be reexamined, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the number of animals on the ark that represented all these basic kinds was probably much, much smaller. Much, much smaller than the number of variations we see alive today because of this genetic fractionation.
Mm-hmm.
As they get off the ark, they establish new population, and then the populations break up and spread apart and become isolated. Each example now has a smaller segment of the genome than the foundation parents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the
literally a chip off the
wall. Yeah, yeah. But just chips.
Just chips.
Just
chips.
Yes.
Now it's possible to bring all those scattered populations of one particular kind intermingle the DNA and get back to the original.
If you can find them all.
Yes. And I always ask my class, where do you find the original dog that got the boat with Noah? On the streets of Tijuana.
I don't think so.
And I would ask, where do you find the original people? All the different people. In Hawaii, of course.
Now, because it's likely that with genetic fractionation and this distribution, that you're going to have, and you constantly have groups that are going extinct. And so it's likely you're going to have some of these representations that go extinct and carry the only copies of their alleles with them to the grave. So they truly become extinct. Those genes become extinct. But apart from that, if you collect them all together, like you say, Don, and bring back into a breeding population, you can get an approximation of the original parents. And so John Sanford and Rob Carter and maybe one or two other people that they're working with are hopeful that they can reconstruct Adam and Eve's genome.
Wow, that would be crazy.
That would be wild, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
you'd have to go to Hawaii.
I heard a certain pastor say, and it was speculative, and he was speaking about how, you know, we translate and take it from his side, and I think he was saying that the word is a curve, and how it could be meaning, you know, God is performing the first surgery, and he's actually taking from the curve of the DNA and making a replication. And when you said that, I don't know, this came to mind,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, she was an exact DNA structure just in a female
disease. Well, when he said, you know, this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Mm-hmm. Sorry. I suspect that maybe she was a chromosome of his chromosome, with the exception of the Y chromosome.
Yeah.
She can get one of those.
Yeah.
Got two X's.
Yeah.
Now, God may have done some additional infusion of variation in the process of creating Eve, but I suspect she was basically a clone of Adam.
Mm.
Unless, like I say, God deliberately created new alleles, so there were, like, for each characteristic, there'd be four alleles instead of two.
Yeah.
And, you know, that'd double the amount of variation.
Yeah.
But,
a lot of gene pool that would be able to be produced.
Yeah, yeah. But it's an interesting thing. Scoffers just love to talk about Adam's rib and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And say, well, you know, if that were true, then every man should have one less rib and things. And, you know, how foolish did poor Adam go around with one less rib his whole life? Probably not. Turns out that today, when surgeons need to reconstruct bone material, like a jaw or something, you know, that is really seriously damaged, they have to do facial reconstruction. Guess what they use? A rib.
Mm-hmm.
They go in and take out a rib. And if they're careful in removing the rib to leave the, what do you call it, the periosteum alone, the little membrane that surrounds the rib, if they can slice that, remove the rib, and leave that intact, it'll grow a new rib.
Wow.
So, I don't know, I sort of suspect maybe God really used a rib. Just, you know, I don't know why he needed a whole rib. Just take a little DNA out of one, and one cell should be sufficient. But, hey, he knows how to do that stuff, and I don't, so I'll let him. That's right. Okay, let's see here. I've already lost my place. Oh, yeah. Question 2, Chapter 3. Including microsatellite DNA mutations could conceivably double the mutation count per person per generation from 100 to 200. And I don't know if it's on the loaner books or not, but in the current version, the question that came from is on page 40. And in question 3, true or false, although we do not know the precise human mutation rate, there is good reason to believe there are more than 1,000 nucleotide changes in every person, every generation. And we started out talking about 75 to 175. Now, in this sentence, it says there may be as many as 1,000.
That's true.
Question 4. There is no selection scheme that can reverse the damage that has been done during our own generations, even if further mutations could be stopped. True or false? Then question 5. The 2007 ENCODE project found that essentially all of the human genome is transcribed, most of it in both directions.
True.
Okay, if you're satisfied with your answers, well, let's see, we didn't review. Let's just talk about it real quick, but these, still you're putting down your own answers on your papers, right? Just what you currently think, huh?
That's not completely too long.
What is both directions mean, Jim?
The DNA splits to be transcribed, and you got two strands of it, and so it's always been thought until very recently that it was just the linear sequence on one side that was read. And now it turns out that it's read, both sides are read, and apparently in both directions. So it's, you know, you've got a linear sequence, and it's read from one direction, read from the other direction, the other one read from one direction, read from the other direction. And so the level of complexity just goes out the roof. Let's take a look at the questions for Hubble Bubble. First question, true or false? The only thing astronomers can really measure is light.
True.
And did you hear a comment during the course of the DVD that said that?
Yes.
Next question, true or false? All the stars and all galaxies could fit inside a ball the size of the moon without touching. True or false? Well, you did talk about a ball.
You did.
You talked about the diameter of the ball, actually the radius of the ball, and said that all the stars and all the galaxies could fit inside that ball.
I just don't remember what size that ball
was. That was from the Earth to the nearest star?
There you go. Which would probably be a little bigger than the moon, don't you think?
Yeah, just a little.
Okay. Oh, well. Give that away. Like I say, these are my attempts at being tricky.
Yeah. I wasn't sure, like, when you said that, like, was he thinking about, like, if we had the moon and we're looking out into space, you can fit all the, the physical size of the stars.
Yeah. But he was talking about, our sun is here, and Alpha Centauri is out here, and we'll let this be the radius, and we draw a sphere. He said, all the stars and all the galaxies would fit inside that sphere without touching one another.
What's that number of stars? 100 billion? 100 billion?
10 to the 22. So, let's think about it. Yeah, I can tell you pretty quick. Hang on a second. I have to look at it.
6 times 6 is 12. Oh, a lot bigger than that, yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. I'm going to have to redo it. 1, 2, 3.
That was a bit of a
zeros. Okay, so there's 1,000, million, billion, trillion, quadrillion, quintillion, sextillion. Ten sextillion.
Big number.
Yeah, that's a whopper. Okay, question 3. All the stars and all the galaxies could fit inside a ball whose radius is the same as our distance to the sun as, what? Our distance to the sun's nearest star, Alpha Centauri. So that was on. Question 4. Dr. Hartnett works with clocks that are accurate to plus or minus 1 second in 100 million years. True or false? Assuming the guy tells the truth. There was a sentence to that effect, I think. Okay, question 5. According to Dr. Hartnett, redshift can result from any of 3 different causes. Doppler shift due to velocity. Gravitational effect, clocks tick faster at higher altitudes and slower at lower altitudes. And C, cosmological, the expansion of space itself. Okay. I will let you draw your own conclusion and put down the answer. Duh. Six. There are 2 classes of hot Big Bang models. Now, this is something that was spoken of in the DVD. Unbounded, centerless space, infinite in expanse, and unbounded, centerless space that is finite in expanse. True or false? And 7, true or false, Dr. Halton Arp was banned from the U.S. telescopes because he showed quasars are far, far away. And 8, true or false, Dr. Hartnett believes quasars are white holes where we can still see creation actually happening 6,000 years ago. Now, okay, it's 11 o'clock. My little thing will go off in about a second here and we'll be done. So sign your names to your papers, turn them in, and they'll be part of your grade. I'll give them back next time, and you can hang on to them and use them to study for the midterm. Ah, class is over. Dismissed. Yeah.